From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. New York Times best-selling investigative author Edwin Black comes to our area next week for a series of speaking events. His work focuses on topics related to human rights, genocide, corporate crime, and government corruption. We'll explore the history of the American eugenics movement and other surprising links to Nazi Germany. And with record high rainfall this winter continuing to cause problems across southwest Florida, we'll explore current conditions for Lake Okeechobee, the Caloosahatchee River, and Gulf waters, along with what local officials are doing to help better address the problem in the future. Plus, we explore a new study linking exposure to a particular algae toxin through seafood to increased risk of brain diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. First, this news. For our final conversation today, we turn to some intriguing new research about a commonplace algae toxin and how chronic exposure to it could be linked to increased risk of brain illnesses like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or ALS. The study comes from the Institute for Ethnomedicine and the University of Miami Brain Endowment Bank. It was published last month in the research journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Joining me now is the report's lead author, ethnobotanist Dr. Paul Allen Cox with the Institute for Ethnomedicine in Jackson, Wyoming. Dr. Cox, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Good afternoon, John.
And I remind listeners to join our conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Dr. Cox, tell us about this study, this amino acid in question here. It's commonly produced by most blue-green algae?
Yes. We have been studying a very puzzling paralytic disease among the Chamorro villagers on the island of Guam. Mm. And we discovered that blue-green algae, which we call cyanobacteria, present in the roots of cycad trees that they use for flower, produce this unusual neurotoxin called BMAA. We've found it in the brain tissues of people who died of this disease, which combines aspects of Alzheimer's disease, ALS, and Parkinson's. But what it really wanted to prove the case, I think, was an animal model. So we, on the island of St. Kitts, at a wonderful research facility there, were able to find that if we added BMAA to the diet of vervets over about a five-month period, that they began to develop neurofibrillary tangles and amyloid plaques, identical in shape and structure to what we observed in the brain tissues of the Chamorro villagers of Guam.
Wow. I mean, how did you go about measuring the, the development of these brain tangles? Was it through, like PET scans, PET scans?
Well, no. What was quite interesting, we have a wonderful support group in Miami at the Miami Brain Endowment Bank, and there the director, Deborah Mash, and really a wonderful neuropathologist, David Davis, were able to very carefully do scans, electronic scans, to see these neurofibrillary tangles and amyloid deposits in the brains of the vervets. What was interesting was there appears to be a very clear dose relationship. The more BMAA the animals received, the greater the density of these tangles. We also found that if we added a common dietary amino acid called L-serine, which is in our diet, that it significantly reduced the density of these tangles. So we're pretty stunned by these findings because it indicates that chronic exposure to this cyanobacterial toxin, at least in the case of diet, seems to account for this ALS or Alzheimer's-type disease suffered by these villagers in Guam.
So for these, you know, Pacific Island villagers, for them it was from a plant that had the BMAA in it, but you're saying it could also be coming from like shellfish that we might consume that also have it.
Well, there's been a lot of interest around the world now in looking at ways that this BMAA gets into the food chain. Our colleagues at the University of Montpellier in France, a team led by Dr. William Camus in the neurology department there, has found that people who are involved in the oyster farming industry and who eat a lot of oysters have a much higher risk of ALS. And then our colleague at Dartmouth Medical School, Dr. Elijah Stommel and his team, have found in New Hampshire and New England that people live next to lakes that have chronic algal blooms seem to have a higher incidence of ALS. So there appears to be some indication that exposure through shellfish, certainly, and possibly other ways, could expose people to this toxin.
Wow. And did the vervet monkeys who were part of this research, did they themselves begin to exhibit signs of reduced cognitive brain functioning, or you were just able to notice in their brains the beginnings of those brain tangles?
Yeah, this was interesting because we really didn't know what to expect when we began the research. And after, what would happen is that each of these vervets, which were housed in groups and very large enclosures, would, at the end of their meals, they would be offered a piece of banana that had in it either some of BMAA or some of the just rice flour as a placebo. After 140 days of this exposure, animals that had received the BMAA seemed to be slightly hyperaggressive. There weren't profound neurological deficits, but they did have what would be consistent with an early stage of the disease among the villagers. What's interesting is that these two neuropathological features, tangles and amyloid deposits, are found not only in the Chamorro villagers of Guam, but they're also found in Alzheimer's patients, and these are the two neuropathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's. The disease that we triggered in the vervets it really resembles what the villagers had, in that they had pretty dense tangles in limbic areas of the brain, but very rare or sparse amyloid deposits. So they're not quite the same as Alzheimer's patients, but to our knowledge, this is the first time that both of these features have been seen in any animal model. So there's some real interest in this paper, I think, that goes beyond just the village ethnobotany that we started out to do.
Certainly, certainly. And, you know, blue-green algae blooms are somewhat common here along the southwest Florida coast, sometimes shuttering water supply plants or closing swimming beaches. Should residents be alarmed?
Well, you know, the first thing I want to do is to reassure our listeners that I myself love Fort Myers in Naples, Sarasota area.
Okay.
Naples Botanic Garden was one of my favorite places, so I don't want to spread any alarm. But what we think we stumbled on is a gene-environment interaction, so that people that are vulnerable to certain types of toxins should protect themselves against exposure. These vervets all were homozygous. They all were positive for the APOE4 gene, which in human beings tends to increase the tendency to develop Alzheimer's disease. So what we suspect may be the case is that most of us probably can tolerate small amounts of this toxin and metabolize it or excrete it with no problem, but there might be a few individuals with a genetic vulnerability, and if our reasoning is correct, then it might be important for those people to avoid exposure to harmful algal blooms.
And in terms of protecting yourself from exposure, is it more than just, you know, maybe avoiding seafoods, perhaps, if there is some kind of bloom going on? Or, can skin contact do it? What are the other routes of exposure?
Yeah, these are real unanswered questions, and we just don't know. What we do know is that shellfish, particularly oysters and mussels and some crabs, we've tested crabs and lobsters in Florida Bay, if they come out of the areas where you have these intense algal blooms, they actually have the toxin that they've absorbed in the tissues. Most of the seafood that we would eat as fish don't have it. So we're very focused now on shellfish and bottom-dwelling fish. But I have to emphasize that our results really have been focused on this little village in Guam and don't speak to the broader issues of Alzheimer's or ALS. And really, that's just through extrapolation. So a lot more work and research needs to be done to see if there's a link to these other diseases.
I see, I see. Could there also be maybe a link to, you know, not just like these vervet monkeys here, but to people or marine mammals?
Well, you know, we're very interested in that. Our colleagues at the Miami Brain Endowment Bank have done some really interesting studies on dolphins up in Indian River Lagoon that were beached. And they found in their analysis of the brain tissues that these animals had BMAA in their brains, whereas ones that were in the open ocean, perhaps were hit by a boat, that those didn't have the toxin. So we're all starting to wonder a little bit now if maybe some of the marine mammals that are exposed to the toxin develop dementia. My grandpa here in the West, he used to get lost trying to find his way home. He couldn't quite find his way home, and maybe some similar process was occurring in those dolphins. So there's a lot of interesting aspects to this, but really much, much more work needs to be done. What we do know now is that the people in this village in Guam who have such a high rate of a Alzheimer's and ALS-type disease have this neurotoxin at high levels in their food supply, and we know from studies of vervets that chronic exposure to that toxin produces that same sort of brain tangles and deposits that the villagers have. What we don't know is how that relates to Alzheimer's, ALS, and perhaps Parkinson's elsewhere. We just don't have enough research right now to say anything conclusively.
Okay, so the takeaway for your ordinary resident is somewhat limited at this point, but what about the takeaway for the scientific research community? Does this, you know, demonstrably show a causal relationship between exposure to BMAA and the accumulation of these brain tangles, these amyloid plaques?
Yes, that's true. And so one thing that's sort of hopeful coming out of this, maybe 2 points. First of all, we think that this model can be adopted by other researchers to rapidly screen new drugs for Alzheimer's disease. At this point, there's no animal model previous that shows both tangles and amyloid deposits. So discovering Alzheimer's drugs has been a very expensive process. Pharmaceutical firms typically spend $1 billion and up to 10 years because they have to test them in people. Here we've got a very rapid and inexpensive way that Alzheimer's drugs could be screened at a fraction of the cost and much more rapidly. So that's exciting. The other thing that we're very excited is that our discovery that a dietary amino acid, L-serine, which is found in eggs and in sweet potatoes, soy products, that seems to be neuroprotective, at least in the animal experiment. So we've just completed now a phase one FDA-approved trial for ALS patients to see if it's acceptable or safe to treat them with a fairly high-dose L-serine. We finished that trial. It looks like the patients tolerated it well. So at this point, we're looking for $2.5 million to move to a phase two trial for 120 ALS patients to determine if L-serine can slow the rate of their disease.
Wow.
We won't know until we get this in the clinic, but certainly in the vervets, it did very much slow the development of neuropathology.
Wow. I mean, so you're really looking at clues here towards potentially curing these, you know.
Well, that's our goal here. The other thing is we are working now with Dartmouth Medical School to begin a phase one trial for patients with mild cognitive impairment, the earliest stages of Alzheimer's disease, to see if adding L-serine to their diet can slow their progression towards Alzheimer's. So I'd say our study has a lot of hope in it. In general, it's probably wise for people to avoid harmful algal blooms, which look like sort of blue-green scums on the water. But I think more than alarming people, I just say there's some real hope from the study that it just might lead to new therapies.
All right. And do you think research like this could or should lead to federal regulators like the FDA perhaps considering consumption guidelines specific to BMAA?
Well, I think that could happen in the future. We'll have to see how the public health authorities deal in the future. We know that for some toxins, such as brevetoxin or paralytic shellfish poisoning, that already state health departments regulate seasons, and if they see that shellfish are rich in these, that they can stop harvest. So the more we know, I think the better we can protect ourselves. And I guess the final thing I'd say about our piece is that based on our research, it does appear that there's a very tight link between environmental health and human health. And we think that these new data should add a little bit of impetus towards efforts in Florida and elsewhere to protect our water supplies and to try very hard to get clean drinking water and to prevent pollution from causing harmful algal blooms elsewhere.
All right, and I think you've just brought us full circle there, Dr. Cox. That is all the time we have for today's show. We've been speaking with Dr. Paul Allen Cox, ethnobotanist with the Institute of Ethnomedicine. He is the lead author of the study we've just been discussing that was published last month in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B. Dr. Cox, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
There's more information on today's show, as well as past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Ching Kui and Jessica Mazaros. This is WGCU, Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.